Hello, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. We welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. I am Lynn Curtis, co-chair of the club's art forum, along with Ann Smith, who's back here. This program is part of the 2015 Platform Series Music Matters, sponsored by Ernst & Young and the John and Marcia Goldman Foundation. I'd like to introduce our speaker, Michael Morgan, who is an award-winning musical director of the Oakland Symphony, where he has just celebrated his 25th year. He is the... He is the music director of the Sacramento Symphony, the Sacramento Opera, artistic director of the Oakland Youth Orchestra, and the Festival Opera in Walnut Creek. He has appeared as guest conductor with most of America's major orchestras and is a chamber musician himself. He has won awards for his adventurous programming and community leadership, firmly believing that music is the catalyst for bringing communities together. Michael Morgan is indeed a person to whom music matters. Thank you.
Thank you. And so when they asked me to come and talk to the Commonwealth Club about orchestras and community and all that sort of thing, the first thing I thought was, I'm actually going to bring in some of my composer colleagues, because I believe they are the key to both the present and the future of symphony orchestras. These days, we have orchestras that will, everyone's having difficult times financially, but rather than be more adventurous, rather than be more bold, we'll have some that will retreat into more traditional programs, thinking that that's how they will win their audience. What I always find very heartening is that once an orchestra goes back to, if they have been doing any sort of interesting programming, and they go back to really, really traditional, overture, concerto, symphony programs, everyone is as bored as I am. So they very quickly abandon that and start to do something more interesting. And what is more interesting is actually new music, which pushes our history forward. And to me, the other thing that's even better than new music in the abstract is new music that is created in the community where the orchestra sits. And so I have invited three of the Bay Area's most accomplished composers, and three whose music I like, to speak with us about the impact of the living composer on the orchestra, and also the impact of orchestras on their lives. And I'm going to start, because I want the David Conti and I are the how do I put this? We are the seniors here. And so I'm going to have the seniors speak first. Before we move to our junior colleagues. And also because David has taught for, how long have you been at the conservatory?
30 years.
30 years has taught at the conservatory, and has in addition to his own wonderful compositions, has turned out some really great students, and I've played some of their pieces also. But the reason I actually want to hear from David at first is because he's had so much experience both passing his knowledge on, but also just thinking about why any of us do this and why it matters that you pass it on to another generation. So I wanted to start today by talking about just the role of the composer and how you guys see your place in sort of the musical landscape, because to me, they're more important than, I think they're the most important people in the whole business, because without them, the rest of us have nothing to do. I could have assembled a panel of conductors here, but if you've ever seen conductors try to share anything. So definitely composers were the way to go. So David, why don't you talk a little bit about just how you see the role of the composer and how you see just your role in community.
Well, thank you, Michael. Is it working? First, let me say I'm delighted to be here with Michael Morgan, who I've known for 25 years. We first worked together in 1994. And Mason Bates, who's my new colleague at the conservatory, and Gabriella Frank, who I'm just meeting for the first time. One thing that I would say immediately, one of the great things about being able to travel, as I think we all do, attending concerts in different cities, both in this country and even in Europe and Canada and around the world, is that it gives you a perspective on the Bay Area. And I can say without hesitation that the depth and level and diversity of music making that's going on in the Bay Area is unequaled in any city in the United States. We have simply more. We have our top tier ensembles like the symphony and opera and ballet and all that, but we also have this large number of metropolitan orchestras, of which the Oakland East Bay Symphony is one. There are 39 opera companies in the Bay Area. I learned at the Opera America conference last year. There are more choruses here, having served in the NEA on the choral panel a number of years in the 90s. The Bay Area always got the most grants of any city, more than New York, more than Minneapolis, more than Washington, which are other important cities. And so I think there's something going on here that's exceptional. It's one reason that I feel I have such success in recruiting students to come to San Francisco, to come to the conservatory, but also one of the main selling points is that you're going to live in the Bay Area and you're going to have lots of opportunities. And in the audience today, there are a number of our composers. Some are current composers. Some are alumni. We have a large community of alumni composers who don't want to leave the Bay Area. And after they get their master's degree, they stay. And a lot of them, they find work. They maybe take a couple of years to keep honing their craft and building relations with performers and ensembles in the area, and maybe we'll go on to do the final doctoral degree. And so we're in a very healthy place. And Michael is an acknowledged leader. And I remember before I even met Michael, I was told about him. He said, "Do you realize Michael Morgan performs a new American piece on every program?" And I don't know if that's, I think it's maybe
it's almost true.
Once 90%.
In a while, once in a while, we take a night off and do all dead guys. Once in a while. But it's very, very rare.
Well, and I had the honor last February. I'm on the board of the American Composers Forum, which is now the only national service organization for composers. And we, every year, give champion awards, which is a very kind of competitive process to, I think we give three a year. And Michael was the recipient last year, and I was there to help present this award to him. And I was able to say at that time how the sense of community that one feels in Oakland when one goes to those concerts and just the makeup of the audience is absolutely unique. And I think I said something like, it makes me think of Mary Poppins. It's a jolly holiday with Michael instead of with Mary. But so all that's to say is that we're in a very rich area. And I guess the last thing I'd say to answer the question about the role is that I think, you know, to be a composer is a long and expensive and arduous process. In the history of music, there are very few autodidacts. Most composers have very long and elaborate technical training to do what they do. And hopefully it's all in the service of providing music that gives players and audiences a transcendent experience. So I know what I try and do as a composer is that I have the composers that I love and admire. I often think, what would they think of this piece? Would it please them? And that I want to create a piece that gives my audience and my players the same experience that I have with the great works. So in that sense, I feel I'm always kind of communing with the great artists of the past, the great composers of the past. And when I say transcendent experience, I mean that a work has a kind of level of concentration of feeling that requires a certain kind of attention and memory to grasp in such a way that you enter into the experience of listening to the piece as it unfolds and you simply are in another place. And this is, I think it's a great human need, It's a need that people really want, regardless of all the troubles we have financially. People still, they want to go to concerts. They want to have, you know, they want good music. They want exciting operas. They want to participate in music as choral singers or in whatever way they do. So I see the role of composer in that way. And also, there are now something that's changing that I know my colleagues can comment on, is that there are more and more ways for composers now to make a living. And the Bay Area is kind of proof of that. Composers can do many different things. The old path, which I followed, which has been great for me, of going to school for a long time and then getting a college job, and my particular job still affords me a great deal of, I teach really two very long full days a week, but I have enough time to do my own work. Now that model has been greatly expanded, and that's a very healthy thing. And in fact, the Bay Area in some ways is a model of entrepreneurial activity in terms of ensembles forming, recording companies, publishing companies. We're a center of classical guitar. So we're in a very great place and in a great time in the history of our art. And I think most of us who live here know that. But so I hope maybe that gets us started with what we can talk about today.
Well, while we have your voice in our ear, did we get the technology to work here? Or do we know?
I think so. I think Michael's hoping that...
If we did, I'd like to hear just a couple minutes of music after each of you says something. If not, you'll just hear more of us talking.
Well, of course, music is worth a thousand words, I think. I always think of that great Mark Twain line, though. I'm told it's better than it sounds. Because often when composers talk about their music, they talk about it so much, and then you think, well, is that really what I heard? But... what I need to try and do is see if this works.
You wrote that?
That's wrong. Okay, hang on a second.
Pretty.
Oh. No? Oh, gosh. I want to play the one. I may have to ask. There we go. Okay. So this piece I chose because it's an old piece. I was as old as my colleagues are, I think, when I wrote it. It was the first collaboration I had with Maestro Morgan. I wrote a ballet on the Edgar Allan Poe story, The Mask of the Red Death. You have to remember, in the early 90s, this area was devastated by the AIDS crisis, and that was one reason I chose this subject. And I wrote what ended up being a sweet, sweet number one. I never finished the ballet, but this is the last scene of the ballet. It's about 5 minutes. And if you know the story, there's a kind of medieval town that's been ravaged by a plague. And the rich citizens of the town, led by this arrogant prince named Prince Prospero, have decided they're going to wait out the plague in the castle, and he's going to give a party, a mask. The mask, in this case, is referring to a party. He's going to give a party, and they're going to just revel it up and wait it out until the plague passes. And so in this last part, I need to read my very brief note. The king says, it was folly to grieve or think. So it starts with a fanfare that accompanies the prince's announcement of the impending doom sweeping the country. He invites the courtiers to escape to the safety of his castle. They respond in a conga of denial and debauchery. I decided on the conga to express this kind of particular feeling of people trying to forget what was going on around them. It's, I think, slightly perverse. After dancing themselves into a frenzy, a crash on the tam-tam announces the return of the opening music of the menacing Red Death to accompany the four welders who secure the gates through which the revelers disappear. The solo xylophone representing the mocking voice of death has the last word as the curtain closes. So I hope I painted a picture of what this piece is. And this is at the old home of the Oakland Symphony, the Calvin Simmons Theater.
This is me,
and
us
you conducting
doing this?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
You don't remember, depending 1994.
Depending how this goes, I might be leaving in a minute. Go ahead.
Well, I think it's a wonderful performance. For me, it was really my first performance by a really professional orchestra, and it was a great thrill. And I could say about Michael, as Robert Shaw, Poulenc said about Robert Shaw, he said, this man understands the exact flow of blood in my veins when he conducts my music. Okay. You have to tell me if it's too loud. Help us get the volume up, or maybe that's as loud as it was. It? I am so sorry. Mason thinks it should be louder, and I tend to agree. And Mason, you're the expert.
It's a classic thing, you know, the sound guy is between you and 40 virgins. So I don't think we're getting it as loud as we want. But
Do you want to take 20 seconds?
No, I think we should just...
All right, okay. You have to strain to hear, but it's actually quite violent and exciting, I hope. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, I can stay. No, if someone tells me they're going to play a recording of something I conducted 20 years ago, I look at it more of a threat than anything else. So, Gabriella Frank, who was actually born in Berkeley, and whose music I first came across when I was looking at scores at ASCAP, American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers. And even then, her work jumped out because we're looking at tons and tons of music from tons and tons of people. So, and this was several years ago now. And so the fact that I retain any names at all from that is like incredible. So, and I was actually struck by it. And I'm going to say now, I'm playing Mason on our opening night in October. I'm hoping that in a June concert to play some David Conti. And Gabrielle's going to tell me what she wants me to play next season. So that's the order I'm going to play these people in now. So Gabrielle, why don't you talk a little bit about being a composer and being a composer and growing up in Berkeley. And then you also brought an example.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's wonderful to be here. And yes, I am a Berkeley hippie. And I wound up there through a pretty haphazard route. My father's a nice Jewish boy from the Bronx. And as a World War II baby, he, like a lot of Jews, liberal Jews of his generation, grew up with a real sense of the world as one being one that you had to go into and try and make better. So he was among the first wave of Peace Corps volunteers when Kennedy started this program in the 60s. And was recruited to go to the beautiful country of Peru, and this is where he met my mom in the 60s. So they fell in love after knowing each other, you know, 2-3 months. It kind of takes my breath away when I think about how different their upbringings were. She didn't grow up in the mountains in Cusco or Machu Picchu, which is Peru, you know, what's most famous for. She grew up in the coast, and she herself is part Cantonese Chinese and Peruvian of mixed Inca descent. So she heard a lot of different languages spoken in the household, and I cook a pretty mean chifa dish, which is a Chinese Peruvian. San Francisco is wonderful for its Peruvian, Chinese Peruvian restaurants. And Dad was a grad student at Berkeley, and you mentioned Mark Twain. My dad has been an editor at the Mark Twain Project for almost 50 years now at Berkeley. And as a grad student, took this job in an independent scholarly office that opened up and never finished his PhD, realized he didn't want to go into a career academia. He wanted to be a, by God, honest scholar. And, you know, imagine this kind of upbringing that I had in Berkeley in the 70s with a very diverse background, a father who was bringing home the example of Mark Twain, a first great American writer, to use everyday American vernacular as beautiful in his mind at British rhetoric. And he was dropping off the G's, and he was able to render very ordinary lives to very profound topics. So I had this model of mining from something that's common of the people. And so I was learning from a South African refugee piano teacher, Haydn and Handel, and I did the Junior Bach Festival. I did all these things that we still have in the Bay Area, alongside going to places like the Julian Morgan Theater in Berkeley to hear música andina, or Andean music. So you don't hear too much about Central America, South America anymore, but in the 70s you really were. And with the fallout between Allende and Pinochet in Chile, or the La Guerra Sucia, the dirty war in Argentina. So this was something that was very much in the air, and a lot of refugees were coming out, opening up chifa restaurants in San Francisco, and Andean music with these other guys with the colorful ponchos and the pan pipes and the quena flutes and the little charango, ukulele-like type guitar. They're everywhere now. They're in the subways, and in the 70s, they were finding hospitable home in places like Helsinki and New York and Berlin and here. So we would go to these concerts, and I would see people of mixed Asian ancestry, like my mother, and people that didn't look Mexicano. They looked bien peruano. They look like what my mother looked like, and I see how happy she was. And so I started going home to the piano and trying to make the piano sound like pan pipes. And I would just spit around with my thumbs on the piano. I was already experimenting and trying to make it sound like a charango if I saw this kind of technique. And I would just go to the piano and kind of shiver at the piano, and it would do the same thing. And I was, now I get paid for it. You know, now it's my career. So, you know, I wouldn't be here except for a civic initiative, right, that my father joined the Peace Corps. And so this is very much in my blood. And I remember when I made that decision to go into classical music, I still remember that diary entry that I wrote, thinking I don't want to become rarefied. I don't want to just play for audiences that have access. I have to help out with the access. So I've been very fortunate. I won't go into detail. I've been very fortunate to have a good life as a composer. I'm currently composing residence with a couple orchestras, Detroit Symphony with Leonard Slatkin and the Houston Symphony under Andres Orozco Estrada from Colombia. Two very different orchestras that wanted a composer that could write symphonic music at a high level, but obviously invested in the community. And this is something that's very much in the speak of a lot of orchestras. Now, orchestras have different definitions of this. So sometimes if their backs are against the wall, they're trying to find new audiences. So it's coming from a place of grooming ticket buyers, which can have some advantage, but is not really for the long haul. Then there are others that want to get into the community and want to invest in education, are patient, want to see some payoff tomorrow, but are willing for that payoff to happen in 10 years. And so composers are asked to do a lot more than simply compose nowadays. They need to be articulate about their vision, and hopefully a vision is deeply personal, but it's something that others can step in with. And what I remember making this decision, well, I'm not going to be a famous composer and have a big career, because I want to do fusion. I want to bring in Peruvian music with classical. That's really my background, really in a very organic way. And at the time when I made the decision, nobody was going to South America for classical music. Everybody was going to Europe. They were going to Berlin. They were going to Paris. So I was okay with that. And instead, the opposite happened, because Latinos were voting more. You know, we decided the last election, we have more economic power and political power. And I realized, wow, I'm really more in step. So the role of the composer, I think, and really any artist, I think, is you got to develop your craft. You know, there are episodes sometimes where the artwork is not that fine. It's not at the level you would like. It's meant to be a community work. And I think we need to demand just as high a level artistically so that people don't make allowance for the community works. It's not meant to be a one-off. So in working with Detroit, for instance, there are specific activities. We're working in Detroit Medical Hospital, for instance, with kids that are dying. It's the first time I've been working in hospitals. There are kids that are not there on Thursday that were there on Tuesday. It's really tough. And we do music making with them, and I help them compose. And I'm working with their staff of music therapists that need music for the preemies. So this kind of composing that we do, they'll have very specific parameters saying, well, the preemies, they need very still music. No vibrato, no intervals greater than a third, and have to be at a certain tempo. So now I'm used to virtuosi. I'm used to people playing up in nose-picking land that we talk about, you know, and that can play anything. And so to suddenly just go, oh, my God. And the reason is because these preemies, if the music is too active, it surprises them, and they lose all the 30 calories that they just spent an hour ingesting in nutrition. They're so fragile. So that is composer in the community. And it takes a different kind of mindset. We're not necessarily tutored that in the conservatories. So my life now is a mix. I'm playing in Carnegie Hall later this fall. So I have that kind of thing. Then I'm writing non-vibrato music for tiny, tiny little human beings. And Detroit is in a very interesting stage of its life as a city right now with declaring the bankruptcy, our first city at that level. They're not like Stockton that did the same thing. So every time I go about every 6 weeks or so, I make a visit to Detroit. I see some new area of the city that has developed. And the Detroit Symphony and the DIA, Detroit Institute of the Arts, are the two main arts organizations that are really investing in the community. It's a lot like Oakland in that way. Houston Symphony has completely different needs. They're really capitalizing on my being able to speak Spanish and go into the community and to try and bring in school programs to bilingual students, and that's a whole different thing. This is a long, haphazard answer, you know, for how, you know, composers need to be groomed to be, yes, conservatory brats and have all the skills and use your doctorate, but also to take on the role of politician sometimes or ambassador, but it has to stem from a personal, you know, vision. Perhaps I should play something so you hear a little of what that personal vision is. Although the last few years have seen mostly symphonic works, I'll share a secret with you. At heart, I'm a chamber music composer. I like the small forms. I feel like I can't walk away from the orchestral opportunities. I grow so much every time I do one of these. And I'm writing my first concerto for orchestra for Detroit, my first evening-length requiem with big choir and and the Orchestra for Houston. But the small forms remind me of what I have with the limited, quote, limited resources of folkloric ensembles in Peru. So this is a very short example. This is called Zapatos de Chincha. Will we play through your laptop?
Or? I'm asking to eject this. Okay.
This is from a mixed quartet, and where I mix and match. And this was a community work. This group in Nashville, of all places, reached out to a Peruvian American in Nashville, not known for classical music, happening. They got a Grammy on their first CD, which it was just wonderful what you can do. Yeah. But they wanted something that could work well in a concert hall, yet go into these community centers that may or may not have a piano. So for this mixed quartet, there are movements where I mix and match, depending on the resources of that hall. So this Zapato de Chincha translates to Shoes of Chincha. Chincha is a southern coastal town in Peru, famous for its Chinese population and its black population. They walk around speaking Quechua, Indian, not Spanish. And every February they have their Verano Negro, Black Summer Concurso, the contest. Buscando Negro Mas Negro, looking for the black man blacker than any other black man. And part of the contest is a cajon competition. And the chinos will actually play wearing shoe polish on their face. And Chinese people in Peru are stereotyped as having good rhythm. So they win. They win these competitions. I mean, the issues of racism, class, you know, stereotypes. I feel so gringa. When I walk around, I'm always locked in the jungle of the Peru trying to figure out, you know, where I stand in all of this. I don't know how we're doing here.
I reject it. It's not. Oh, here, try it.
Can you drag it?
There we go. Yeah. Got it.
Good
Thank
timing.
You very much.
But this would be, I believe, track two. And it's a short example. It's only 3 minutes, two and a half to 3 minutes. For cello and clarinet. That's it.
These are the Alias Chamber Ensemble based in Nashville. They have CDs out. They are marvelous musicians. They're all members of the Nashville Symphony that need an outlet, and they donate all the proceeds for all the concerts to charity.
Finally, Mason Bates. Mason Bates was brought to my attention, do we even remember how many years now? I really don't know.
Oh, it's 2001.
2001, okay. Okay. So I was on the board at the International House in Berkeley, and there was someone at International House who wanted me to meet this Mason Bates person.
Hey, wait a minute. It was my teacher, John Corleone.
Oh, that he did.
What the hell are you talking about?
I heard about you from Cal also.
So, okay.
Yes. Yeah, I heard about you from more than one source. And generally when people tell me about a composer, it's like, okay, all right. I'll meet them, but it's usually just to get it off my books so that I can say that I met them. And then you meet them, and you meet somebody like this guy, and he brings a piece that I think, did I program it right away, or did I hesitate for a moment?
It was the next year. I mean, which is soon.
In orchestra terms, world. Yes. Yeah. And now he is the star of everywhere. He and our other Bay Area composer of some note, John Adams, they sort of duke it out for who is played the most by American orchestras now. But yes, that's Mason Bates. You're at Chicago Symphony? Are you still at Chicago as the composer in residence?
I just finished up there.
And you're at the Kennedy Center now?
Yeah, I'm at the Kennedy Center.
Yeah. So he's doing okay. So why don't you talk a little bit about and he has this whole other life in addition to being classical. He's like, you know, way cooler than the rest of us, really. So why don't you tell us a little about yourself?
Well, you know, the great thing about being a symphonic composer, for me when I first started, was just the sound of the orchestra. I mean, all this business of community, I've only really started to appreciate as I've gotten introduced to all these orchestras around the country. When I first started, I was a high school student in Virginia, and I just loved the sound of the orchestra. I learned about it through, you know, a lot of psychedelic rock that had orchestra backdrops. My father played a lot of swing music. I kind of got into Gershwin. A small orchestra in Indiana commissioned my first piece, and it kind of got me into the orchestral field. It's been, you know, as I've really gotten to know all the orchestras that make up this huge collection of grassroots, this grassroots-like world that is the American symphonic scene, that I've really appreciated what it means for an orchestra to be in a community and for a community to have an orchestra. And I guess, you know, one big thing that I've realized is that, you know, an orchestra can impact a musical scene and a community beyond the musical scene more than almost, or at least in a unique way, that's you know, something that almost no other institution can equal. And one of the reasons, of course, that it's bigger than a garage band. I mean, there are a lot of people involved in an orchestra, and so all of these people that make up an orchestra are members of the community. They're teachers. That was my first, you know, teacher in Virginia. She was a part of the, you know, the choral music community in Virginia. And, you know, beyond that, the people that go to orchestral concerts, you know, we're all experiencing music in a way that we almost never get to these days, which is that we listen to it in a very focused way when there's nothing else going on. I mean, that's the thing that I love so much about symphonic music, is that you, as an artist, I mean, just speaking, you know, from the perspective of a composer,
you have this incredible opportunity to do big storytelling because the audience is absolutely focused on the orchestra in a way that we don't really get. You know, these days, a lot of music happens while something else is going on or it's accompanying a film. So, you know, I think in a way, the more plugged in we get, and I'm part of that problem because I love electronic music, but I mean in terms of devices and things, the more valuable the orchestral experience is because we do have this, not only a purely acoustic most of the time, you know, space that we go into, but we also have a kind of listening that we don't really do elsewhere. And it takes. I think anybody that's alive will appreciate this music. But some of it does take, you know, a bit of time. You know, when I take my son, who's six, to the orchestra, no, he's not going to like make it through the Franck D minor right now. But getting there is an incredible thing for his mind and his, you know, his outlook. You know, one thing I think that, you know, orchestras can do is to look to some of the great orchestras on the level of Oakland and see how they are impacting the communities. You know, obviously the orchestras that are hitting out of the park, you know, financially in terms of prestige, the top seven, they have the luxury of you know, an audience and a board and endowments and things. But when you look at something like Oakland, you know, you go to the Piedmont Theater, that's an incredible, incredible vibe, even if you were just deaf and you just went there. It's an incredible experience, everybody there. And then the music making is at the root of it. I mean, Michael programs a really big diversity of composers. I think one of the things that composers, one of the perceptions that composers have about the orchestra is that, almost everybody, from film to jingles to pop to electronica to symphonic, we all love the orchestra, but how do you get into it? And I think it can be a bit of, it can seem like, you know, a closed world. Michael is a great example of why that's not always true. When I first met with him, I mean, he had programmed the piece in about an hour. granted, you know, I had my teacher who put us in touch, but, you know, Michael's a very open and available conductor, and I think the great region orchestras around the country are the ones that are often the ones that are bringing a lot of the new energy in terms of not only programming but format. I personally would love to see a kind of Manhattan Project go into transforming the program book. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be free. But, you know, with production, I think we could transform the way we transmit information to the audience. You know, there's a lot of dead time in an orchestra concert where pianos are moved on and people are dragged in and out, and I think it's a great opportunity for people to learn about what they're about to hear in a way that doesn't interfere with the actual music on the program. That's the thing we don't want to screw up. You know, we don't want to necessarily have a slideshow going, you know, going during Carnival of Animals or something, but there's a lot of opportunities to learn about what's happening, and I think you know, new ways of learning about what we do in the way that you might do it at a museum where you just walk around and you see, oh, this is what I'm seeing right now. That could be a model for us going forward. I think, you know, not always does the music making literally come out of the community in a way that you can hear in the piece. Actually, the piece for the Chicago Symphony, I'm going to play y'all just a minute and a half excerpt of, called Alternative Energy. It kind of did in that I wanted to tell this energy story from like 100 years ago, starting in like a Midwestern junkyard with junk percussion and a fiddle player conjuring Henry Ford, who played the fiddle. I don't know if you knew that. I didn't know it. And each movement goes kind of 100 years forward into the future. And the present-day second movement takes place in Chicago. And I went up to Fermilab, which is a particle accelerator up outside of Chicago, and actually found sounds and went around and recorded sounds from this facility. So in the same way that we went with the percussionist to this junkyard outside of Chicago and dug up, you know, mufflers, fenders, and, you know, all these things that we could create an instrument out of on the stage. We did that, I did it electronically. So I'm just going to bypass the computer. May I have the eighth-inch cord? Give me the cable. Because I want to start in the middle of something and, you know, deal with the CD. So 20th century. So here is a one-minute moment when we get to the end of the Henry Ford movement that has a lot of junk percussion clamoring away, and we get to this particle accelerator, which, like the crank that appears earlier in the piece, kind of spins around the audience. ¶¶ So obviously we're not going to get there with this volume level. So I really agree with what Gabby said. You know, when you interact with the community as a composer, it should not be a one-off. I mean, it should be something, you know, because sometimes you do hear about these kind of grant-driven projects that you know, are kind of exciting, involve a lot of people, but, you know, might get performed once. And I think there are ways to really have an orchestra impact the community, either compositionally or through the way that they reach out. That really is substantive, and it really has to start with the programming. And you know what Michael's doing, including live living composers on his concerts and mixing up the format. I mean, that's really a model for everybody.
So we've talked a lot now about the role of the composer, and we're going to, in a moment, have you ask us questions about what you want us to say. But I just want to sum up by talking about the role of orchestras, players, and conductors in that without, particularly the driving of conductors. If conductors don't actually sign on to things like this, they don't happen. There's no one else really to push an orchestra to be this interesting. And generally the orchestras that are not interesting, especially during the concerts, it's because the conductor is not either trying to be interesting or is conducting in so many places that he or she just does his party pieces at various places and doesn't really push to add new repertory, to add new music to the repertory, or just doesn't work hard enough at making things interesting. So you have to have that leadership from whoever is in charge. And there's a lot of people that are doing this now. There's still not enough. And as Mason was saying, a lot of the most interesting things are happening down at the regional and smaller orchestra level. Mostly, it's a lot because we can be flexible. Whereas some of the big orchestras are, you know, they're like ships. Turn the wheel, 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 and then the ship goes... So they can't be as flexible. We, on the other hand, can actually move. And then if the and also when the orchestras are hiring conductors, he said, if they would hire people who would do something interesting, also that would be helpful to all of us. We're in a phase now where and these young people aside, because they are both very good. It's great in composition. It's not faring as well in the world of conducting because now we're hiring fetuses to run major orchestras. And that's part of the reason why the standard repertory is played in such an uninteresting way now is because you don't get good at the standard repertory until you get old. And so the fact that, you know, when I was growing up, when we were little, we didn't expect anybody to take us seriously when we did a Beethoven symphony because we didn't know anything. So now, of course, we hire conductors because they make a pretty poster. That's fine as far as your posters go, but maybe someone wants to go have an interesting concert now and again. So you have that dichotomy between the two things. And there's some of these people who will grow into being really interesting conductors, but one of the things I admire about the Chicago Symphony, as an example, they always hire a great conductor. They are not trying in any way to impress anybody with how pretty their conductor is. They want somebody who really knows what they're doing, and I admire that enormously about the Chicago Symphony. That's my conductor rant for the day. it could go, really, that's the short version. But in any case, the notion that we've talked a lot about the various trends going on in orchestras now. We've talked about teaching. We've started off by saying that music does, in fact, matter. And Mason hit on a very important point. A symphony orchestra, and many of you have heard me say this before, a symphony orchestra is capable of bringing people together and bringing kinds of music together in a way no other ensemble is capable of doing it, just because of the sheer number of people and the diversity of their talents. And if their talents are actually used to in a way that makes programs interesting, then you actually get something that's interesting out of a symphony orchestra. The Oakland Symphony is really, it's full of musicians who can do lots of things, but the nights when I think I'm the proudest are when we do a jazz piece and all of a sudden it turns into the world's biggest jazz band with people throwing solos all over the room and all that sort of thing that they did not go to conservatory to learn. They learned that in a bar somewhere. But you put all of those skills together and you have really, you get a really interesting product, whether you are doing those jazz pieces or whether you're doing pieces by these guys or whether you're doing a Beethoven symphony, because it causes you, the other thing about programming and not putting all the old music together and not ghettoizing the new music either, so that you put old and new music together, is that it makes you listen to both differently. If you put a standard piece beside a piece by one of these guys, you listen to the standard piece differently and you listen to their piece differently. And that's how you actually come away with people who actually can appreciate music in a sort of wider way, not to mention, and those of you who are followers of the Oakland Symphony know that my big rule in programming is that nobody has to like everything. No one. No one. And the only person that has to like everything even during a concert is me, and if I'm not conducting, even I don't have to like everything. So in order to serve a community as diverse as Oakland, this is what we have to do. Do we have time for a question or two? Does someone have a burning question or two to any of us up here?
It's been said that it's a bad idea for composers to conduct their own music. I like their views on that.
They are not conductors. My view on that is what counts. And actually, the composers who are trained as conductors are really quite good at it, and the composers who appreciate training as a conductor, when they conduct, they are good at it. It's the people who are sitting down and all of a sudden stand up with a stick and say, I'm now a conductor. Those are your problems. John, if you ever get to see John Williams conduct a concert or conduct a rehearsal, the most efficient thing you've ever seen, the respectful, musical, wonderful. I love that guy. So that's an example of someone who conducts and composes. Do you guys conduct, any of you?
A little bit. I know you do because you
conduct chorus.
Yeah, I think that that's an interesting question. Both Copland and Stravinsky, you know, had major careers as conductors and.
Players often, they appreciated playing for them, but they did complain about them. But I think they show, often a composer can show something, if they have at least a baseline of technique, they can show something about their own music that no one else can show. Stravinsky, the way he conducts a certain rhythm that he felt and created, no one else can quite do that. But I think when you compare Bernstein's recordings of Copland with Copland's, the Bernsteins are, for me personally, far superior.
One more quick one? Anyone? Oh, excellent. Oh, wait, front row. We'll do one more.
Yeah. I'm struck by the dedication it takes to become a full-time professional musician, whether it's a composer or a performer or whatever. But some of us took a different path at age, 18 or 17 or something. We still have music going through our heads and we have some, ability, but we haven't developed it to a high level. So are there opportunities for someone to participate in music as a performer in ensembles and whatever, short of having gone to the conservatory kind of thing?
There are lots here in the Bay Area. There are choruses of every level. There are orchestras of every level. And if you want to play in an orchestra or play chamber music for that matter, we were just talking about our friends, the Del Sol Quartet. They run a symposia for adult amateur chamber music players. And I'm trying to bring them, have them come and house that for a week at my Bear Valley Music Festival next summer. But it's a chance for adults to come and play at the level they play and be coached by a world-class string quartet while you as an amateur play. We value amateurs enormously because, first of all, a lot of them went on to make more money than we do, so they are our great supporters. But also, they are the people who really appreciate what we do because they understand the struggle to get there. Everyone here has worked a long time to get to where they are. Some of us a real, real long time. They'll catch up.
And also in the Bay Area, there's a richness of choruses, which I know all three of you have written for, including my favorite, Chanticleer. And so what's opportunity there relative to orchestras, or is it the same here?
David's the choral master.
Mason, a lot about it.
You're always so generous, Mason. I appreciate it. And I love the piece you wrote for Chanticleer. I haven't gotten to hear your choral music yet. I look forward to hearing it. It's true that choral music is the province of amateurs, which is, it has a kind of regenerative power for that reason, and everyone should have a voice. I always like to, should be in touch with their singing voice. Zoltan Kodaly, a name many of you may know, and you know one of the foremost centers of Kodaly education is in Oakland. He was a fine composer who also thought very deeply about music pedagogy and has a whole methodology of training children that is used all over the world. And what he said that's very deep is he said, the health of a musical culture is based upon the cultivating of the singing of the musical young of that culture, the folk music of that culture. And I think this is absolutely true. And so, and the Bay Area is a center of choral singing, and so I encourage everyone to sing. Maybe in order to join a chorus, if you haven't sung a lot, you may need some basic vocal instruction, just getting in touch with what breath is and how you support your sound with the breath. And I think that as composers, we appreciate in the audience, when audience members have some experience making music, obviously their whole experience is deepened of what they perceive in the music that we write.
Okay, we're in overtime now, so I'm going to just say one final thing. That is, one of the reason that I asked these particular three people to come and do this today is that I knew, for me, it would be the easiest hour of my life. I would just sit back, and they would just take it. And so they are fantastic. And a big thank you to all of you for being interested in this subject, because when they asked me to do this, I also wondered, is anybody going to come to listen to me talk about this? So I very much thank all of you for being here today. And if any of you had questions, there are quite a few composers and younger composers and things in the audience. If you had a question that perhaps you did not want to shout across a crowded room, please come up and see us afterwards. Thank you.
Okay. So our thanks to Michael Morgan and to David Conti, Mason Bates, and Gabriella Frank for a wonderful panel discussion. And now it is the time to bring our meeting to a close of the Commonwealth Club commemorating the 112th year of enlightened discussion. We are now adjourned.